Hey podcast, before we get into podcast, when I say hey podcast, I mean all of you who are listening. So first of all, thank you for listening. Second of all, two little things for you to know about before we get into today's podcast. One, the Monday to Monday playlist that Mike Boyd and I curate each week on Monday with a lot of incredible music from a ton of emerging stars, especially if you're into Latin trap and hip hop. It's really made for you. Obviously, if you're Caleb and you love metal, not for you. But if you are the majority of people that enjoy hip hop or Latin trap, very, very much up for you. And so you can see that on Apple and on Spotify, Monday to Monday. I'm not sure exactly what, if you search Monday to Monday, it should pop up. That should be good. Search Monday to Monday on those two platforms to subscribe to the playlist. And I hope you listen, and I hope you enjoy this podcast.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
What's up, podcast? For today's episode, Gary sits down with the former CEO of the Campbell's Soup Company, Douglas Conant. He shares an incredible story from his new book, The Blueprint, of how being fired from his job of 9 years led him to becoming the CEO of Campbell's. So make sure to hit him up and leave a review to let us know what you thought, and I hope you enjoy.
Hey, everybody. Really excited about today's podcast. Excited about the book, but more excited about the gentleman that's sitting in front of me. Doug is an iconic, I like using that, iconic businessman and CEO in the corporate world, and was at the helm of one of VaynerMedia's earliest clients, Campbell's, and an avid tennis fan, which is one of the first things I think about with him, but yeah. Somebody I've stayed in touch with over the last decade who I have a lot of respect for, and when him and his team reached out and said, hey, got a new book out, we'd love to be on the podcast, I couldn't have been more excited for this moment, and so here we are. LinkedIn community, I know you're watching live. We're taking phone numbers on Facebook where we're live as well. I'd really like to give some of you access to Doug because I think the wisdom and the experience and the blueprint that he brings to the forefront is a valuable one, and I'm excited to give you context. I think a lot of times a lot of the entrepreneurs and executives from this show get enormous value of some of the greats that have done it, and I feel like Doug sits in that category, and so I'm really excited to see you, my friend.
Yeah, it's good to see you too.
Doug, why don't you give some context? Because I do have an audience that I think will be hearing about you for the first time, and I'm excited about that. So why don't you give a little 2 to 3 minute rant, call it a comic book number one origin story stuff. You can go all the way back to who you were as a kid or go into your professional stuff, but take the floor for 3 to 4 minutes for context, and we'll take it from there.
Sure. I grew up in a very modest household outside of Chicago. And
were you a Bears fan?
Oh, big time.
Well, Allen Robinson, the star wide receiver of the Bears, literally just walked out of here 2 seconds ago.
And I missed him.
We got to find him. Well, Shrug, go find him. We got to get him for Doug.
If he's here, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, well, it's done. We're going to figure it out. I don't think
we're
he left.
On it. Go we're ahead, on Doug. It, man.
We're moving. Improving early. Quick interruption,
now,
just like I like
get,
it.
If you could get Rizzo or Chris Bryant here,
are you a
that
huge,
would be perfect.
You're a well, speaking of Cubs, sports cards are back. And I'm buying Javier Baez rookie cards like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
I think Javi's a real
that.
Player. So go ahead.
All right.
Outside Chicago.
I grew up in Chicago and migrated to the corporate world very early on. I tried to play professional tennis. That lasted a nanosecond. And then discovered I couldn't make any money. Went back, finished my MBA, went to work in the corporate world. Worked there for 40 years.
It's unbelievable.
My first performance review, 6 months into my job. You know, your boss signs it, and your boss's boss had to
read it
and make a comment. My boss's boss on my first performance
and
review.
Real quick, this is an exciting story already. You're 6 months in. Where are you working? What
I'm
are you
working
doing?
I'm working at General Mills in Minneapolis.
And you are
large
a?
Large consumer. I'm in brand management, a large consumer goods company.
What brand are you on?
I was on Betty Crocker Potato Buds and Specialty Potatoes.
I love this stuff.
And then I moved on to Betty Crocker Brownies, Puddings, and Pie Crusts. I did it all there.
You were a Betty Crocker
but
juggernaut.
I was writing the back the message on the back panel from Betty Crocker. As Betty Crocker.
So you are Betty Crocker at some point.
I was. Yeah.
I love this.
My mother was in shock. She said, what are you doing? I'm saying, I tell her I'm like writing Betty, my
Mom.
Betty Crocker recipe.
I love it. Anyway. So anyway, 6 months
but
in.
6 months in, I have my first review, and my boss's boss, the only line he writes is, you should be looking for another job.
Really?
First, you know, and I've moved to Minneapolis, Minnesota. Don't know a soul. And
it's cold as shit.
Yeah, it is. It was March. The first 18 days I lived there, the high temperature was below zero.
Unbelievable.
So it's below zero. I'm getting feedback. You should be looking for another job. I don't know anybody.
How'd you handle that?
I did all right with it.
Good for you.
You know, I had, you know, you have two choices.
Fold.
Or double down.
I love
and
you.
I doubled down and I was grinding it out.
What did you learn from that?
Well,
what's the takeaway from that? Was it about interactions with your boss? Was there some other random insight?
What I learned from that probably was that I could play through it. Mm. Early on, I was like a deer in the headlights. You know, my first day of work, I went there off the tennis tour, and I had a everybody was wearing pinstripe suits, red ties, white shirts. That was sort of the this is mid 70s, and I show up in a khaki suit with a bright yellow shirt, a big wide Madras tie, and brown earth shoes, and a tan line from where I had my headband, and my
mustache?
Fu Manchu mustache.
Wow.
And here I'm showing up at a button-down collar place. And
did anybody make a good, funny comment in the first 24 hours?
No, but I started.
The looks.
I will tell you, I started to look like everybody else about 3 months in.
I understand.
And I spent probably my entire time there, my focus was on fitting in. Because my feedback early on was, you're not fitting in. So I was trying to figure out how to make this work. It was a whole new world. It'd be like walking in here for the first time and you're...
Yes, the energy here is a little different.
Wow.
Yes.
Steroids.
Yes.
But at any rate, and I was trying to fit in.
Yes, I understand.
And I was trying to figure out... Well,
did you like the work? I mean, obviously, staying in the industry for 40 years.
I like the people. More than the... The work was fine.
But you like the people part.
It was interesting. But the people...
I like
and
that.
Being part of a large community, just like you've got here.
Yeah.
Being part of a large
energy.
Community, people give each other energy. And if you needed help, you found somebody to help you.
Did you like playing doubles, or did you in tennis? You liked more of the singles aspect.
I would both. If you're a tennis player, I was better at doubles. But if you're a tennis player, you're sort of a lone wolf anyway.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right.
Because it's not a team sport.
No.
You know, you're playing for yourself.
Yeah.
But so
what
I'd
happened
spent
immediately
a lot of
after
time
that?
Fitting in. Eventually, I got fired from that job.
That's epic.
Nine years in, I went in. I was working. I had the world's greatest job. I was director of marketing for Parker Brothers Toys and Games.
Oh.
Nerf Sports. I had two little kids. Nerf Sports, Nerf Football, Nerf Hoop.
The green and
Monopoly.
White Nerf Football is like the most Americana for me because that's how I became a Jets fan. Like the Nerf, spongy, Nerf, green and white football is like one of the most near and dear things to my heart.
Well, a lot of us grew up with them.
Yep.
Yeah, you got one right
here. I got a little leather there, but like that's what it looked like.
Well, now you've gone upscale.
Well, no, that's fair
enough. But when you started,
go buy me a Nerf football. I don't want to be known as upscale. Keep going.
Anyway, so I went in on my bosses. I went in to work on a beautiful spring morning.
This is now 9 years later.
9 years later, up in Boston. And the receptionist said, the senior vice president of marketing would like to see you. I go up to his office and he said, your job's been eliminated. You need to be out of here by noon.
Simple as that.
And 9 years of my career was over in a snap.
So real quick, you were General Mills for how long before you
went
to Parker?
That was 9 years. They General Mills owned Parker Brothers.
I didn't know that at the time. Yeah. Got it. And later sold it to Hasbro?
Eventually, yeah.
Eventually. Well,
eventually they spun it off and then Hasbro bought it. Yeah.
And that's it?
So, but you know, it was not easy.
How old were you, 30?
I was 32.
And what, like crushed?
That was the most devastating day of my career.
No question.
I had.
Did you have a mortgage?
I had two kids. I had a very large mortgage.
it's real stuff.
You know how am I going to make this
so
work?
I had to go
home and tell my wife.
Yeah, I'm not to completely go into that wound, but like you're a big boy now and had a lot. Wait till everybody hears. He ended up being the CEO of Campbell's. So like he won, but like tell me about that day. Who'd you call first? I'm actually very curious about that.
You didn't know what to do. You know, I was told
you were
I
in a
needed
coma.
To be out of there by noon.
You clean your desk.
Yeah, clear your desk, put it in a box.
Did you talk to anybody that you worked with?
No.
Because you were just in a daze.
I was absolutely in a daze.
Did you go to a bar right after?
I went straight home.
Okay, fair enough.
Told
people do go to
my
bar
wife, my two kids, my
how old
the,
were
the dogs,
kids?
The cats, and
how
the
did the
craziness.
Cats take it?
I don't know. I haven't never talked to them about it. But
nonetheless,
it was hard.
What happened next?
Next, later, they were so anxious to get me out of the building, they forgot to tell me what my what my package was. So one of the HR people called me and said, I'd like to fill you in.
Yeah.
And I swore at him and hung up the phone. I was so pissed. It sort of all came out
on
the phone.
John McEnroe came out.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Yep, and?
And after about two more hours with my kids running around and the dogs and the cats, I thought I needed to get a job. I better call that guy back. So enough of this home life.
I tell you,
I called him back, and that same day, and they sent me to an outplacement counselor who saved my life. Saved my life. And that same day, I had had the worst experience of my career, and I mean that over my 45-year career. And that afternoon, I call my outplacement counselor, a guy by the name of Neil McKenna. He answered. This is before cell phones.
Yeah.
And before caller ID.
Of course.
He answers the phone. Whoever calls him, and he says, "Hello, this is Neil McKenna. How can I help?" And he was there for me completely. I called him. He said, "Come right on over. We're going to work through this. We got to focus forward. I know this is tough
stuff.
Shocking,
but yeah."
And he saved my life. You know, in that moment. And you know, the funny thing was, the first thing he had me do, and we talked about this right away, he said, "I want you to handwrite your entire life story for me and your family story." And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? I got to get a job. You want me to handwrite? He said, "Yeah, I want you to handwrite it. I want you to feel this. Handwrite your life story, everything. Everything you can think of. Leave nothing out." So I spent 2 weeks writing my life. 2 weeks writing my life.
No wonder
story.
You have a book.
But well, you know, when you're unemployed, you have a lot
of time.
You have a lot of time. So I wrote for 2 weeks, and it was.
And in third grade, Susie Thompson and I.
No,
like,
but I was writing about my family coming to this country, finding their way, and all of a sudden, my losing a job paled in significance.
Love that.
And I know you count your family.
Yes.
Same
perspective.
Thing.
Perspective.
And
it's
all
powerful.
Of a sudden, I had a different perspective, and I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, "God, I got to get over this." You know, this is not the worst thing that's happened to my family in my history.
Right. Yeah.
And so it really helped me get some perspective.
And then what happened?
This is what was interesting. He read the story, and he got to know me. And within another 2 weeks when we met, he said, "I don't get it. This just doesn't add up." And I said, "Why?" He said, "The person who wrote this story is a fierce competitor and is determined to make a difference. And you're showing up.
Tail between the legs.
Yeah. And you're not showing up. The person I'm reading about and the person I'm meeting are two different people. I'm an introvert, even more than I am now. And I wasn't talking unless spoken to. I was very polite. I was trying to fit in, make it work, keep my job, and do all this.
Defense.
Yeah. And I was reacting to things. And he said, "You got so much to offer.
Go.
But you're keeping it all bottled up inside." And that's where the spirit of this book started to be born because, you know, my observation, and we do a little story. David Brooks from the New York Times writes about, are you living for your resume or your eulogy? Are you trying to get all the tangible things, you know, the new car, the corner office? Are you living for that? Or are you living for what they're going to say about you when you're gone? And he said, you get seduced living for your resume. And I started realizing that you got to put your resume and your eulogy together, and it should be knit together with a sense of purpose that grows out of your life story, not out of all the testing and all this other stuff. It grows out of your life story, because as we see in the book, your life story is your leadership story. It's where it comes from.
I met with a young woman that doesn't work here, and she wants to go do something, and she's not leaving because she's worried that her resume is going to show she only worked at this place for 6 months. I was like, it's 2020.
Yeah.
Nobody even fucking reads resumes. What are you talking about?
Yeah. That's a good point. When I lost my job, it's like you were ashamed that you lost a job and you didn't tell anybody.
People still are that way.
And it
stigmas are real.
Yeah.
So what happened with your career? Where did you get picked up?
Well, I ended up going to Kraft. Had a good run at Kraft. Where I met.
Did you move to Peter?
Where I met Peter.
Yep. Did you go to Chicago?
I went back to Chicago, tailed between my legs to a degree because that's where I grew up.
Yep. But Kraft was a job.
I had a great job there.
What was the entry point? What brand?
I was a category manager for Kraft salad dressings.
Mm-hmm.
But I went on to be director of corporate strategy at Kraft. And then I got recruited right after Barbarians at the Gate.
Right.
By KKR, I got recruited.
Tell everybody a little bit about, this is an iconic book in the corporate world. I want some of the youngsters and entrepreneurs and outside the corporate world to hear this. Tell everybody just a few seconds on that iconic book and story.
This was the story of the second half of the 20th century. It was the world's largest LBO at the time. It was KKR buying RJR Nabisco. RJR was a money machine, tobacco machine. They acquired Nabisco and some other food companies and built this massive business. But the handwriting was on the wall for the tobacco industry. And so business started to soften. KKR came in and made it the world's largest LBO. They planned to flip it in 5 years. It took us 10. And there was so much money coursing through the veins of this company that it was like the Wild West of corporate spending. And there were stories.
Wasting.
Yeah, there were stories of the chairman, who's since passed, sending the corporate jet to pick up his dog on the East Coast to come out to Mission Hills, California for a golf tournament on the West Coast.
The dog.
And we had a team. He had assembled a team of the greatest athletes of all time.
Oh, I know this story.
The Johnny Unitas, all of them, they really had no income in their retirement. They hadn't made the money, right? And so they started off, they had about 30 people on payroll who lived off RJR Nabisco and showed up at events and everything else. It was a larger payroll, I believe, than the Yankees at the time. But it was the who's who of Hall of Fame land
because he
all
loved
the sports
and just wanted to hang out with those guys.
Yeah, hang out. And, you know, it was it worked. So it was just an amazing excess. KKR bought it. We had to sort of wind all that down because corporate governance was getting in the way. I mean, you couldn't do that, some of that stuff. And we ended up taking a lot of cost out. I had a good run there. The last 5 years, I was president of Nabisco Foods running that. And then we sold that, actually, back to Kraft, who I had left. And then I was recruited to go help fix Campbell Soup Company, which was, I was there for a decade as CEO. And that was
great.
That was wild. I went in there and headquartered in Camden.
How did that feel? Remind me, I apologize. Was it directly to CEO?
Yeah.
So how did that feel? How did it feel on the dawn of knowing you're getting offered the CEO job of one of the most iconic American, I mean, this is now your full career at this point, right? From the early days and Parker Brothers and General Mills.
You should be looking for another job.
That's
you
right.
You should be cleaning
right.
clean out your desk.
Did you try to,
now
did,
I'm CEO.
Are you more like me? Did you try to find those two guys that wrote that review the night
I'm
before
you
took? Yeah,
I'm
I would have found those fuckers. Like, hey, Ronald, I got something for you. So
they know.
Of course they
Believe
know.
Believe me, they know.
I know they know. Did the... Did it feel special? Was that a?
It was awesome.
Was that just? It was a headhunter.
It was
it a headhunter?
Yeah, but we had been acquired, and they knew I was the market knew I was not going to go back to Kraft.
Right.
So there were several opportunities percolating. I ended up picking the Campbell one.
Were they all CEO jobs? Or?
Yeah.
Got it. So
that's the only one I would have
that go
done.
To at that point in your career. Yeah. I get it. Was
and
that exciting?
And I had always said, you know. I'm slow, so I'm not as fast as you. But I had always said I want to be a CEO by the time I'm 49. And
well, it's ironic.
And I was 49 when it happened.
This you'll find funny, Doug. I speak fast, my energy's fast, but I'm actually wildly slow. Like, even this company I'm running now, you know, when we met way back when for some work, this has been built really to buy brands. I'm far more KKR, far more private equity than I am agency. Yeah. Like, I'm actually going slow. The energy's high. I would argue that 49 is a pretty young age at that time of year, of that era, to be the CEO of something like Campbell's.
Yeah, well,
that
was
fast.
It was.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, it
was. What was the biggest challenge with that kind of family. There's a lot of challenges going. I happen to have enough knowledge to know, like, the Campbell's family, like, there's some dynamics
half
there.
The family owned half the company, and they were five families because it was third generation. You know, multiple generations.
That's right, tricky.
And we were headquartered in the poorest, most dangerous city in the United States, Camden, New Jersey.
Challenge.
75,000 people, 70 murders a year. And we were running. It was a canned soup company. I mean, our product had been invented in the prior century, and was unchanged. And I was saying, I was talking to our folks, and I said, "Well, don't we need to evolve?" And they said, "You don't understand. We can run canned soup faster on our lines than anybody else."
You're like, but.
And I said, "But you know, but don't we need more?" And they said, "But we run our canned soups really fast." And so we evolved, but the company.
What's the biggest highlight for you personally in that decade? If I'm saying to you, in that 10-year window, hot take.
You know,
please.
I hit stride. You know, we talked earlier about your resume or your eulogy. That came together for me.
Mm.
I showed up more authentically
during that era.
In that era, actually, the last 5 years at Nabisco, I started to mature. I found my sea legs. I developed the courage of my convictions that I probably hadn't had before.
Love that.
But being challenged at by KKR all the time and the people around there.
Got
5 years in, I sort of hit stride and said, you know, I can do this.
Good for you.
And then so at Nabisco and then at Campbell, I hit my stride. And that, it became one. You know, what I do today, I live for my resume. But I very much, it's in harmony with the things I hope people say about me someday.
Talk to me about the book. And talk to me about the awesome Amy, who has a big title in the book here. And I'm looking.
The awesome Amy is truly awesome. I'll tell you, I'm a 68-year-old white guy.
I've heard.
And I'm writing this book, and I would write it like a 68-year-old white guy.
Respect.
And the book is designed, and we'll talk about it in a minute, to be approachable for anyone.
Right.
And I needed help. And Amy's a 30-something gifted writer. She writes all the social. She's editor-in-chief for Conant Leadership. She writes all of our social media content.
And what is Conant Leadership for everybody?
Excuse me?
What's Conant Leadership?
It's what we run to promote leadership that works in the 21st century, because most of the models
are anchored. Is it a consulting business for everybody who's watching? Is it a consulting business? Is it
We don't do
education?
Any consulting. We don't make money. I don't take a salary. We charge for a few things to cover our costs. If we more than cover our costs, we give it away. And we've been doing this now for like 7 years.
Good for you.
And we're loving it. We're in it for all the right
reasons. Is the book out?
The book just came out yesterday.
Congratulations. Who do you feel like this is going to hit most right in the kind of chest?
This can hit anybody from my kids who are 33, 35, and 38 on up. And I could actually work with college students. The beauty of this book is there is no one right way to lead. You know,
Read.
And if I talk about your leadership story is your life story, your life story is your leadership story, excuse me, your life story is unique.
Snowflake.
And you should lead in a unique way. There are some timeless principles that you should apply, which we talk about in the book, but this book is designed for you to create your own blueprint. Anybody in this room, and it will all be different. I have probably... Because I'm older, I have thousands of books. I probably over 1,000 books in the office. And there are 1,000 books that tell you how you ought to lead.
Yep.
And none of them resonate with me completely. They're good idea here, good idea there. So what we decided to do was write a book that helped people figure out how to lead in a way that worked for them.
How much is relationship with adversity and losing, self-esteem, self-awareness, how many of these, you know?
Well, that's all. I mean, it's all part of it. This is complicated. If it was not complicated,
everybody
would have been
it.
Figured out already. So, you know, and the key to this book is, and all those other books, it's like a diet. After the holidays, you have your diet. You say, I'm going to lose 20 pounds. And here we go. My wife and I are going to start a diet. We last about 2 weeks, and we say, this is never going to work. It doesn't fit in our life. And the way we wrote this book was, it has to nest perfectly, the change process, perfectly in your cockamamie life, the way it exists today. Anybody in your office, all of whom, everybody, feels swamped.
100%.
swamped, right?
It's unbelievable.
And they say, how do I fit this in?
I watch people who have 1 hour's worth of work feel like they're swamped, and I want to kick them in the face. No, it's true. It's the human spirit. Yeah. People fill their bucket with what? Let me make fun of myself. I thought I was the hardest working guy going at 27. I laugh at that kid.
Well, you were pretty hardworking.
I was, fair enough. But really, you know, you hit different gears.
Yeah,
hitting strides,
true.
Right?
That's true.
It is around happiness or what you're supposed to be doing. Amy, jump in here for a second. I just want to ask, go ahead, don't be scared. I just want to ask you a quick question. From your perspective, because I think it really matters and can help. You know, from your perspective, as this book was written, what stood out to you? What was an aha for you, maybe going through the process, which I think sometimes happens, or what was your ambition, or as you were listening and debating and conjuring up with Doug, when you now look at this as a finished product, where do you go with like, oh, I'm really glad this happened through the process, or I'm excited to see this group of people absorb this, and I'm excited, like some random thoughts on that front.
Yeah, so I think one of the epiphanies was anchoring this story in that moment of Doug getting fired, because it brings somebody with such gravitas down to earth, makes them relatable.
Yes.
And it really is the story of the worst day in somebody's life. How
becoming
do you get from that day, and how do you get there?
Yes.
And it's a practical guide. So when you look at a story that big, it can feel too big to be approachable. So that's how we also had kind of the epiphany to make it really practical. People that I talk to my age also feel swamped, whether they only have an hour of work or 70 hours.
Yep.
And they're saying, well, how, I don't feel ready. I need to wait for the perfect conditions to get started on a change process. When am I going to feel ready? You're never going to feel ready. So
Amy,
this is for you whenever.
How much do you feel that is people's inability to have a relationship with other people's judgment?
I'm sorry, say that one more time. I need
to
think about that.
Well, I think it's a, like to your point, and I couldn't agree with you more, like people come up with enormous amounts of counterpoints to why this is a time to do something that would make them happier and more successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something I've been thinking about my whole life. I think one of the great gifts that I was given is immigrant, grew up with very little. And then on top of it, which is rare for immigrants, bad student, right? Mm. That's an added element, which very early on gave me a relationship with losing and being an outsider that made me very comfortable with not worrying about people's judgment. And I observe and I'm like, right, they're scared to quit their good job because they're unhappy because they're worried about their mom's judgment, their husband's judgment, their best friend's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
In what you just said, how much have you observed, what's your hypothesis on how much of this is actually grounded in people's inability to deal with other people's judgment?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you're actually lucky that you failed early.
Agreed.
Because you got comfortable with
Agreed.
It. There's a lot of people, especially who ascend to the levels of leadership that the leaders Doug's talking to, where they're used to being really type A
Correct.
And high achieving. And
Correct.
They're not comfortable
Correct.
With something that's imperfect. So the message in this book is forget perfection. Throw it out the window.
I hate perfection.
It's not going to be perfect. You just have to get going.
Perfection is a disguise for not wanting to do.
Absolutely. It becomes an excuse to just not even start. 100%. Yeah.
I love that.
And what Amy's engineered in here is this, you can start right now with what you have, with what you've got right away. And within a week, you can start to behave in
is
a way that works for you.
Let's get one question in before we wrap up, and then I'll give you the floor to give some thought to the last things we want to say before we head out of here. Yeah, it just makes sense. You know, it's really funny. Podcast form, book form, you know. Ultimately, I think why I wasn't a good student is my relationship with reading. I was never diagnosed, but it's clear to me. You know, I love that people learn in different formats.
Yes.
I love that. Who's this?
Adam.
Adam, don't blow your only chance. Here comes one more. Adam. Oh, I hope we get a voice message so I can leave here.
Hello, this is Adam.
Adam, this is Gary Vaynerchuk.
How's it going, Rick?
It's going
How's
quite
going,
well.
Gary?
Say hello to Doug and Amy.
Hey, Adam, what's going on?
Hey, Doug, Amy. Oh, it's going pretty well. How are you?
Good. What's your question, brother?
You know, I've done some research in the past. I'm actually writing a blog right now. It's kind of funny that I'm even on this, but I'm writing a blog right now, and it's about just talking about employees and clients and just showing appreciation and specifically how to write the perfect thank you note. And I know a little bit of Doug's history and how he has written, I believe, over 30,000 thank you notes. And I just kind of wanted to pick his brain as far as like the impact of just simply showing appreciation and being genuine and like what that means and how do you do that and any suggestions with that. And yeah.
Hey, well, go to ConanLeadership.com and we'll help you even more. But let me tell you, I was an introvert.
Doug, hold on. First, you have to thank this guy for knowing that history about you.
Well, everybody, I'm surprised you don't, Gary.
You know what? No, I did know about the thank you notes. Is the number in the range?
No, he's right.
I did know big time on the thank you notes. I didn't know it was to. I mean, that is scale.
Well, you know, and Gary, thank you. Adam, thank you. When I lost my job, my outplacement counselor said, "You're going to be a horrible interview. You're too shy. You're too introverted. You got to figure out a way to have a signature practice to get a job." And he said, "Figure it out." So I started. I'd come here. I'd meet 10 people. I'd get all their names while I was interviewing. I would go to the coffee shop next door. I would handwrite a note to each of them. I would then walk it back to the front desk, give it to the receptionist, and say, "Could you deliver these today?" I did that everywhere I went.
Wow.
And I started this practice of reaching out in a personal way. It doesn't have to be much. Receptionists had never received a personal thank you note in their life from somebody calling on the building.
That's amazing.
And so I started doing that. And then I went to work at Campbell. And even in Campbell, which was hemorrhaging, 8 out of 10 things being done were right. We had to make some real tough decisions, let go 300 of the top 350 leaders, never been done in Fortune 500 history. At the same time, we had all these people doing good work. So I started writing 10 to 20 short notes a day to employees. I was commuting 2.5 hours each way from New Jersey down to Camden, from Morris County down to Camden. I started reading all the stuff that was going on in the company, and I would write notes to these folks. 10 to 20 a day, 6 days a week for a decade. When I was retiring, the person from Forbes said, "How many of these, I'm hearing all about all these notes from everybody. How many notes have you written?" I said, "I don't know." So we did the math during the interview. We did the math and figured out just the Campbell employees, I'd written 30,000 notes. We only had 20,000 employees. Wherever you went in the world, we were in 38 countries. We were marketed in 125 countries. Wherever you went in the world in a cubicle, if I was to walk out, you would see a note, handwritten note from me.
That's amazing.
In just about every person's cubicle somewhere.
You know what's amazing about that? Adam, any parting shots? Because I'm going to wrap up here, but thank you for that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Adam, make it personal and keep it short.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You got it, brother. You know, it's funny. A lot of people don't know this, but in my transition from the wine business to the tech world, I replied to every single tweet from 2007 to 2011, period. Anybody who replied to me. And I think that's, but it's the same game you played.
Yeah,
it was,
it makes context, right? Twitter, yeah.
You know, like sending a note to Amy and be like, "I liked your black and white jacket that you wore in the office today." Like when you actually are paying attention, when you actually know a little something, it's subtle little things that really, really, listening.
I gotta tell you though, the notes I wrote were not gratuitous, "I like your jacket." They were, "You delivered the business on plan, under budget," or "Nice job with the diversity network." Every note I sent was reaffirming our company strategy.
Respect.
And was talking performance. But, you know, the theme was, I'm going to be tough-minded on standards. We let a lot of people go, but I'm going to be tender-hearted with people. And the people that were getting the work done, they heard from me too.
I love that.
So this is not about...
Mine would have been like, "Amy, good job. We got the pages in, and I also liked your jacket."
Well, I didn't want to...
I wanted
no mistakes.
I respect that. No, I respect that.
You worry that people think, we're just going to hold hands
and
sing kumbaya.
By the way, it's back to the blueprint.
Yeah.
It's back to 11,000 books.
Yeah.
It's, I would have done that, and you would have done this, and that's the biggest punchline. The biggest fear I have right now is in my popularity growth that people are going to try to be like me. I'm an enigma. I was in outer space. I grew up in a very different, I was born in the old country. I'm more similar to everybody's grandfather than I am to them. I'm a different animal. Yeah. Don't do it like me. Don't do it like you. Do it like us in our buying into who we were and how we could do it.
Yeah, it's your story. You write it.
100%.
It's not our story.
That's it.
And all these leadership books are, "Here's my story and here's how you should do it."
It's wrong. I'm with you.
It's the
wrong
paradigm.
Now, if you're the kind of learner that learns from other people's examples, that's why you went on to read those books, because you were able to get a little here, a little there, and at $15, $20 a pop. And if you're a quick reader, you can get value. But you, well, it's a framework.
There are people you can learn from. You know, I met Stephen Covey when he was Stephen Covey. You know, he was advising presidents, and when the student is ready, the teacher appears.
Always.
And he had a profound influence on me. So did Neil McKenna, who was my outplacement counselor.
Yep.
Right time, right place.
Right human.
I mean, there are people to learn from.
Always.
But you have to listen to your inner voice.
Love.
And what our observation is, most people don't know their inner voice. They haven't reflected on it.
They suppress it. Or they fear it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't
fit in.
That's
even better. Because
they fear it, because they hear it, but they don't see it fitting into the narrative that has been forced on them.
Right. Well said. We could have used you when I needed you. Where were you when I needed you?
I'm here right now when it matters. Watch this. Everybody who's watching, go to Amazon or your local bookstore, barnesandnobles.com, and pick up The Blueprint. Doug, Amy, thank you so much.
All right.
As we end today's podcast, I want to give a huge shout out to the people. You know, it's so funny. People that leave reviews and written reviews of this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms just mean the world to me. You've taken an extra 13 to 95 seconds to show love and also give context to people of why this is a worthwhile podcast. So I appreciate that so much. And even more fun, because I think we all love a little cosign or a shout out or a little awareness, I'm gonna have the team give a couple of shout outs daily on our favorite reviews. So Dean, take it away. Which were our favorites this week?
Thanks, Gary. Today's review, Gary, Let Me Know My Work Ethic Isn't Wrong, written in by Kay Wilson, Fit Fizz says, I first started binging on this podcast in late 2016 when I was laid off from a field of work that I hated anyway. I already had a side hustle, but everyone told me that my relentless work ethic and no playtime mindset was irrational. When I found Gary V, I found someone who was saying the same adamant things about the vision for my small business that I'd be telling my friends and family. My vision became my oxygen. They told me I needed to slow down, but I didn't. Well, unfortunately, health issues forced me to put my passion for the grind to make it happen never wavered for a second. Gary let me know I was in the right mindset, in the hard-hitting way that I love, when everyone else didn't. Priceless. Thank you so much for writing in, and remember, keep leaving reviews, because yours could be next.